Well, hi there. My name is John Beck, and I co-direct Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives, so we're just very happy that you're all here today for this brown bag. And I just have a few announcements before we get started. The first one is that our next brown bag is actually next Monday, so a week from today. And Darcy Green and her husband, Jim, have spent a good amount of their life off and on in Benin. And so she currently has an exhibit called On the Job in Abomey, which this fine catalog was done and is for sale at the MSU Museum store on the first floor. But I will send the flyers for that around. If I can.
Sorry. I'm standing on your cord there.
You know, that's always the problem when people stand on your cord, John. We have actually four brown bags in the month of November. It's a crowded month. So our musical brown bag this fall is called See My New Ground Turning, Labor Songs from Appalachia, 1950 to 2018. Sam Gleaves is coming into town to do a concert, so he's going to be doing a brown bag for us during the day on November 16th, and that's across the street in the green room at the library. Then the following Monday after that, Claire Lutz, and Khalid Ibrahim are doing, from the College of Human Medicine, are doing a wonderful talk called Critical Lifelines, The Lives and Work of Personal Care Workers, which is actually based on Claire's work as an Archie Green Fellow with the American Folklore Society. So I'd really commend that to you. These are all gonna come around. And then we're very fired up that Johanna Schuster-Craig from the Department of Linguistics in Germanic, Slavic, Asian, and African languages here at MSU has actually been doing field work on some of the islands of Greece and elsewhere. And she's been working as well with field work with social workers in Germany. And she's doing a talk called Changing the Narrative, Refugees and Social Workers in Germany. And she's very interested specifically in the how it has changed the work of the social workers in Germany to really confront this sea of refugees. So those are gonna come around. Then, we are the co-sponsor of the Ari Olds Transportation Museum Lecture Series. And Michael Rodriguez, who's a wonderful librarian and historian right across the street, just finished the first half hour of a film that he hopes is gonna be an hour that's called Ari Olds and the First Auto City. And so Michael's gonna be showing that and talking in our series at night on November 27th. And last but not least, I don't even have to give that to you because I was gonna give you the entire list, but they're all right here. And so I'll just drop those and you can just pass those around. Okay, so let's get going. John Ernie Fleschner shares his time between the RCAH here on campus and the Department of History. And he's worked in one of my favorite places, which is really Southern Africa. Specifically, my work has been in South Africa, like many of us, but his work really has to do with Lesotho, which is, I think, the only country of its type that's actually landlocked completely by being internal to another country. Maybe there are others that might be the case, but in Africa there definitely aren't. So today he's going to be talking, I believe, from his new book, right? And his topic is Freedom from Migration and Independence as Work in Lesotho, the Dreams and Realities of Decolonization. So please help me welcome John Ernie Fleschner to Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives.
Thanks, John, and thank you to all for being here over the lunch hour today. I guess we get the end of a concert to start us off as well with the bells. As John mentioned, I do my work in the country of Lesotho. For those who might not be familiar, Lesotho is entirely surrounded by South Africa, landlocked, not counting religious enclaves like the Vatican and tax havens like Monaco. It's the only real country in the world that is entirely surrounded by another one. It's roughly the size of Maryland is what people say, which is a truly terrible comparison because no one knows how big Maryland is. It's about the size of Belgium, if you're trying to conceive of it. As you can see from the topo, however, most of the country is very, very mountainous. The populations are very light in the mountain areas because it gets very cold in the winter, regular snowfalls. You can't farm most of the highlands. So most of the population is centered in the lowlands here around the western and northern parts of the country with a few small towns in the interior. As I go through my talk today, there's some important terminology. Lesotho is the modern day name of the country. It's also what local people have called the land. It's the land of the Sotho people, Lesotho. Basutu land was its colonial name that was given to it by the British when they were in charge. People only used it to refer to the government, the colonial government, so I will not be referring to Basutu land very often in this, despite the fact that I'm talking about the colonial period. The people of Lesotho are called Basutu. One of them is a Masutu, and the language and the culture are Sasutu. So there will not be a pop quiz on that at the end, but it's all prefixes at the beginning if you haven't figured out the pattern. And as John noted, a lot of this talk comes from my 2018 book, which was published by the University of Notre Dame Press, entitled Dreams for Lesotho, Independence, Foreign Assistance, and Development. So if you're interested, check it out. This is a series on labor, so I have to say don't buy it from Amazon. Buy it from the publisher. So let's jump into the story today. So I'm going to give some vignettes from, I do a lot of oral history in Lesotho with people who are older now but were young at the time of independence. And so a lot of the book is centered around the experiences of young people. And so I'll be giving you a bunch of stories today of their lives and what they hoped for and dreamed for out of independence. Because when you are young and someone says, hey, we're going to have an independent country, what does that mean? That was one of the questions that drove a lot of my research that I asked all of the people that I was talking about. What did it mean for you at the time? And it's a bit of a difficult question to excavate because of the passage of time and the 40 years of disappointments, of wins, of losses, of just the passage of time that clouds people's memories. So one way I tried to get at that was by looking at what people did in youth organizations at the time, their concrete actions to speak to how they felt, as opposed to asking them to try to recover memories that were 40, 50 years old. So the first story I have for you is of a guy named Raphael Lesedi, and I don't have a picture of him. But Raphael Lesedi grew up in the rural village of Makalaneng Halakota, which is even today a very difficult village to get to. A rough jeep track is about all that we have to get to it. He grew up there with his four siblings in a household headed by his mother, like many in Lesotho, because his father was away in Bloemfontein working for South African Railways. Raphael, like all of his siblings, completed elementary school at the local schools. There were lots of rural primary schools scattered throughout Lesotho because of its long history of engagement with Christian missions. They competed with each other largely by putting up rural primary schools. And then Raphael completed his first 3 years of high school. High school in Lesotho is a 5-year enterprise. After 3 years, you take an exam called the Junior Certificate, after which you move on to the final 2 years and you take the Cambridge Overseas Exam, or COSC, British system. So Raphael completed his first 3 years of high school up through the junior certificate. He was at Mashweshwe 2 Secondary School in Matsiang, and then at Maseru Community Secondary School, obviously in Maseru, the capital. He was in high school from the years 1966 to 1969, which was right when Lesotho transitioned from being colonial Basutu land to independent Lesotho. And Raphael, like many his age, was involved in the youth wing of political parties. in the lead up to independence. He was a member of the Basutoland Congress Party, or BCP's youth wing, but his home village was politically heterogeneous, with people joining both the BCP and its main rival, the Basutu National Party, or BNP. At the time, the national narrative said that the competition and rivalry between these parties was bitter, which it was at the national level. But at the local level, Raphael said relations remained good. They still, you know, these were his age mates from growing up, and they played with each other, you know, hung out, and he said they'd, you know, sit around playing cards and doing whatever. When asked what he wanted to see from independence, he said, quote, "We hope to see many changes, roads and schools and many others, hospitals, clinics, development, right? The infrastructure of a new state, the services that they did not see under colonialism." He also hoped to become a policeman after he graduated, to join the civil service. But quote, "Unfortunately, it was very tough at that time," end quote. Why was it tough for him to join the police? Not just because there were a lot of applicants, but because by the time Raphael finished schooling, there'd been a coup in Lesotho. In 1970, the Basutu National Party held on to power despite losing an election, and they instituted what they called the Dipepechana system, which was a card system. If you were not a card-carrying member of the ruling party, you could not get a job in the civil service. For a young man who'd been part of the youth wing of the opposition party, there was absolutely no chance that he was going to become a policeman in independent Lesotho. Thus, Raphael's dream for independence, quote, "I wanted to stay in Lesotho and work here in Lesotho," was gone 4 years after independence because of his prior political affiliations, and he, like many before him, was forced to go work in the mines of South Africa, where he spent 27 years before retiring back home to the community of Roma, where the National University is today. However, Raphael's education meant that he was somewhat different. Instead of having to work underground in the deepest mines in the world under very dangerous conditions, Raphael, with his junior certificate, was able to get an above-ground job, and the wage increases of the 1970s that the trade union movement in South Africa had fought for meant that he was able to boost his pay and able to move his family in 1978 from the rural village of Halakota to Roma so they could access the better roads, schools, clinics, and facilities there. As I argue in my book, Dreams for Lesotho, Basutu came to conflate the idea of independence and development in the late colonial and early independence periods. Popularly, the co-joined ideas of development and independence came to encompass a set of three shared objectives: desire for projects that would lead to increased material prosperity for both individuals and communities, access to more and better governmental services, and a meaningful political voice both in development projects and in governance more generally within the country. Of course, not everyone agreed on these key aims, and in particular, government officials, politicians, and aid officials from overseas often attempted to use aid and development as ways to centralize government control or to push economic and ideological agendas through the implementation of projects. This again is James Ferguson's argument in The Anti-Politics Machine. Still, despite the limited success of development projects in the early independence period in achieving all of these three main objectives, the idea of development allowed many in Lesotho to hold out hope for the future, both for themselves and for the idea of Lesotho as a country, because of the promise embedded in the ideology of development and working at home. Of course, all of these debates and projects were happening in the shadow, literally, of apartheid South Africa, since Lesotho is an enclave country. Thus, the promise of development projects that would create widespread jobs and material conditions to enable Basutu to not have to go to migrant labor jobs was one of the most cherished hopes and dreams for independence. For generations, Basutu had migrated, legally and otherwise, across the border to South Africa for varying amounts of time in an effort to sustain family homesteads and to support future generations living back home in Lesotho. This is the story of how these dreams largely went unfulfilled in the early independence period, but how people still largely maintained a hope that one day in the not too distant future, their dream of employment at home in a strong, independent Lesotho could be realized. So to get some background before I jump into some of the other stories, we need to understand a little bit about the history of labor migration from Lesotho to South Africa. And Lesotho was not always a labor reserve. In the mid to late 19th century, Lesotho supplied some labor to South Africa, but there were choices. Lesotho was also the granary of South Africa. Before the railroads arrived in the interior, the gold mines around Johannesburg and the diamond mines around Kimberley relied on Basotho grain. And how did the grain get there? Largely came through Basotho teamsters. So there were people, you know, working at home in export farming. There were people working as teamsters on the road with their horse and wagon teams. There were also Basotho going to the mines. They were an important source of hard cash, and especially because Lesotho had fought multiple wars against the Afrikaners in the 19th century, many Basotho went to the mines to earn money to purchase firearms, and modern firearms at that, you know, breech-loading rifles and these sorts of things. These were all important. Once the railroads arrived, however, Basotho grain was undercut by cheap grain from Australia, the United States, and other places where people were exporting in large quantities. And increasing population in Lesotho meant that the arable land, there was a squeeze on the arable land. As I showed already, much of the country is mountainous and not really farmable. So by the turn of the 20th century, Lesotho is slowly becoming a labor reserve for South Africa. This is also, of course, being encouraged by the British colonial administration. Migrant laborers pay taxes reliably. And by South African policies, the mine owners wanted a cheap supply of labor. Lesotho could supply that. By the time we get to the 1920s or 1930s, Lesotho's prosperous period is done. It's a net importer of food. It is a labor reserve for South Africa. I have a whole bunch of charts and figures here that are not my own. I've nicely stolen them, borrowed them from others who do Lesotho's labor history. The key column here is these are the number of Basotho migrants who are working in the gold mines. As you can see, it's a significant number, approaching 100,000 by the 1980s. Basotho make up a key component of the mines of South Africa. It's not just the mines, however, that are drawing Basotho. They're also working in factories. Many are working on the farms, seasonally, of course, though some go there permanently. And it's not just men. Basotho women are also migrating to South Africa, as you can see here. Though, of course, the percentage of migrants peaks in the 1950s at about 27%, falls rapidly after that. That's, of course, because of the apartheid pass laws that forbade women from coming to urban areas to seek employment. It, of course, didn't stop everyone, but it cut down on it significantly. The age chart shows that as well. Young women disproportionately came to South Africa. Men sort of all ages come, but it's mostly young women looking to work as domestics or to live on the margins in the townships, brewing beer, running small canteens, things like that. And they're doing this because there are very few economic opportunities in Lesotho. Where are they coming from within Lesotho? Everywhere. But the darker the region, the more migrants per district. And as you can see, the lowland districts that are the most densely populated are also sending the most migrants. This is where the stress on the land is particularly acute. People just can't make it, economically speaking, from those areas. Colin Murray's book from the 1980s, nicely lays this out, and his story is 100% correct. Again, a lot of numbers here, a lot to focus on. Don't focus on all of it. This is just, why did Basotho come? Number one reason, poverty. Number two, lack of employment. Not sure what the difference is there, but we've parsed it out. And lacking money for specific items. The key takeaway from this chart over here is the percentage that intend to return to Lesotho. The question is, do you want to stay in South Africa? The no's over here are very high by all ages, right? So this is a migration that during the apartheid period, Basotho really don't want to be undertaking. And yet there really is no alternative outside of the lucky few who get jobs as teachers and police and various civil servants back home in Lesotho. Again, you know, most people don't like that they're working in another country. 81% over here say that's a negative about having to travel to apartheid South Africa. I'm happy to send you these slides if you want to really parse these charts later, but they're there. Quick overview of the political changes. I'm guessing most people don't sort of have a schema for the political history of Lesotho in the forefront of their brains. This is First Prime Minister Leyabua Jonathan here campaigning in this shot. I'm going to present this as if it were a nice, tidy narrative. It's not. Right? One thing does not lead to another, lead to another, lead to another, seamlessly and flawlessly. History, as we all know, is contingent. We never actually know what's going to happen in the future. This is very easy for us to conceptualize in our own lives, harder to import back to the past. And so I present it as if it were a cute little one-way street towards independence, but it wasn't. There were significant questions over whether Lesotho was viable as an independent country. It's recklessly poor. It is completely surrounded by South Africa and completely dependent on its neighbor. At the time, it was an apartheid South Africa. So there were real questions both in the British Colonial Office and in, you know, aid groups and NGOs abroad. You know, is it viable to allow Lesotho to become independent? Local people said yes, and they continued to push for it. So in 1952, we have the start of political parties in Lesotho. The 1955 Moore Report, the chiefs and the politicians all expected to get some sort of local legislature. They were very, very disappointed when they did not get it. This is the last time that all the chiefs and all the politicians were united on one thing, which was, we need more political power. After that, when the moves started coming for more political power, the question became, who is we, right? Which party, which faction, how are they going to divide it between chiefs and politicians and commoners, these sorts of things. So 1959 saw the first constitution. 1960 saw the start of a national council, the first body to have limited legislative ability to make some laws. Still a colony, however, so Britain is still retaining the important ones. Still has control over the police, still is allowing the South African special branch to come in, these sorts of things. But this is the start of the devolution of political powers in the three High Commission territories, which are Botswana, Lesotho, and Swaziland. 1964 sees constitutional negotiations, which lead to the 1965 pre-independence elections, and the formal transfer of power in 1966. So this is just sort of a cheap and easy chronology for us here. Obviously, I go into way more depth in the book on all of this stuff. But this matters for how people are conceiving of the idea of Lesotho. It's rapid, very, very rapid. As late as 1959, the British Colonial Office is writing, we see no way for Lesotho to become independent in the next 20 years. 7 years later, Lesotho is independent. So, you know, even in the minds of planners, things change very rapidly. The key here is that local people are driving this process forward, pushing the colonial government, saying, we need these powers. They are ours. We deserve it. This is, of course, the year of the decade of African decolonization, right? As France and Britain are slowly getting out of their African empires. Then we have the issue of the border. The border between Lesotho and South Africa is even to this day very porous. There might be people in this room who've crossed it without stamping their passport every time. It's just a way of life for just about everyone in the region. The rivers that separate the countries for much of the year are a thin trickle. You can wade right across them very safely, very easily, away from border controls. And the mountain borders, good luck patrolling them with any sort of vehicle or police force. But even in the early period, there were border controls. This is the main border post at Maseru Bridge, all prettied up for the 1947 British royal visit. This was a big to-do here. These are the official photographs from that. But for much of the time under consideration here, the only thing Basutu had to do to get to South Africa was to secure a pass from either their local chief or their colonial district officer that says, this is so-and-so, they're from here, they're going there for work. Because South Africa was a British colony, Basutoland was a British colony. It was all part of the Commonwealth. The border was very easy to cross. So if you wanted to do so legally, you could. If you wanted to do so illegally, you could. That said, it wasn't always easy to do so, especially as the apartheid regime started cracking down and making people have to carry passes. So by the 1950s, Basutu are excluded from urban areas unless they're on a formal labor contract. So the gold miners and the diamond miners are all recruited by TEBA, the Employment Bureau of Africa for Africa, which was a mine consortium. So those guys boarded a train in Maseru, went straight to their jobs in the urban areas, no problem. Anyone else who wanted to go to Johannesburg or Bloemfontein or Durban or Cape Town either had to have secured employment already, which was difficult to do from Lesotho, or to go there illegally and face the risk of being picked up by police in a pass raid. So here we see, again, the main border post, not nearly as pretty because it wasn't the royal visit. And then some of the young miners here at Maseru Bridge heading out for labor contracts. You know, these guys are carrying their suitcases all dressed up. They're the formal ones, right? They're the ones who have the contract already. Things change in 1961 when South Africa votes to leave the Commonwealth. At that point, we no longer have the same Britishness, fictive though it was, between the two countries. And South Africa delays for 6 months and 6 months and 6 months the imposition of border controls because it's going to be an administrative nightmare with Lesotho. By 1963, however, we do have the implementation of formal border controls. And the best I can tell is at least a quarter of the population of Lesotho has a passport by this time. Again, mind you, this is 3 years before independence. A quarter of the population has formal identity papers that allow them to come in and out of the country. And then you also have the border communities. So at every border post, you have a town on the Lesotho side and a town on the South African side. The South African side towns do very well because Basutu cross over for shopping, for doctor's visits, for visiting friends and family, these sorts of things. And so you could get a 48-hour pass or a 72-hour pass to cross and go to the local towns and come back to do your shopping. So South Africa benefited greatly from the presence of Basutu migrants really in all facets of the economy. So as we move towards independence, there is a push for development. Right? One of the big criticisms of Britain in the international community in its treatment of Lesotho and Botswana and Swaziland is of colonial neglect. Almost no roads, almost no funding for schools, no clinics, no jobs to speak of. And so people want to know, what have you been doing with your supposed mandate to, you know, seek the betterment of people, right, in these colonial possessions? So there's a long history of pre- and post-independence development failures. The sort of vision for development in Lesotho is sketched out in the 1930s. The 1930s see, of course, the global Great Depression and a crash in commodity prices. It hits Lesotho hard, really hard. And the colonial government is worried about unrest in the rural areas. They hurriedly commission the Sir Alan Pym report, which comes back and says, we need to improve agriculture. Okay, so how do we improve agriculture? Their vision, which lasts into the 1970s and even into the 1980s, is, you know, improve the wool, because wool and mohair are two of the biggest exports from Lesotho, lots of sheep. And then improve rural agriculture, have more extension officers, have demonstration plots to teach the people how to farm better. Because clearly the only issue is that they don't know how to farm very well. Ignoring again the fact that in the late 19th century, Lesotho was the granary of the region. There are some flawed assumptions at work here in these development projects. And of course, they don't do what they are intended to do, which is improve rural incomes, give people an alternative to migrant labor, and all of these things. You know, there's beautiful propaganda shots of the experimental farms with these big cabbages to go sell in South Africa, but it's not a recipe for everyone in the country to suddenly get richer through farming. So these are the development failures of the pre- and post-independence period. And so we get to the independence period. All of the political parties have promised development. This is their vision for independence. We're going to be free. What does free mean? It means we can work at home. There will be jobs. There will be roads. There will be schools. The government at independence really struggles to attract development projects, to attract development funding. Why is that? There's a number of reasons. One, there's a lack of capacity in the government. Again, this was a skeletal colonial administration. The goal was not to cost Britain any money, so they didn't have very many people. It's hard to run a big project if you just don't have people to do so and no planning department. There was also an ineptness on the part of the first Lesotho government. The BNP came to power somewhat surprisingly, even to themselves, and they were, most of the educated civil servants belonged to the opposition, and the government was suspicious of the civil service. It's hard to have a government function well when the civil service and the central government are clashing. And then you also had a general hesitancy on the part of donors, such as the United States, to put money into Lesotho. Why? Because they saw Lesotho as an example of colonial neglect, and they didn't want to take Britain off the hook for what they saw as its responsibility for funding development in its former colony. So in the first 5 years of independence, there really were no big projects in Lesotho, and they largely had to rely on self-help programs and other tiny, tiny projects. What you see here is food aid. World Food Program, United States PL 480 law. This is donated food being handed out as part of a development project. In 1966, the Minister for Works gives a speech. He says the government wants to, quote, transform self-help assistance into a, quote, capital asset to allow for cheap infrastructure creation and improved agricultural productivity while also meeting the basic needs of the population. So what do we end up with? What do we end up with? We end up with a bunch of public works projects where people are literally hacking roads out of the mountain with shovels and pickaxes, working together in labor gangs, creating very small irrigation systems at the village level, projects that are, you know, don't take much capital and rely on quote-unquote volunteer labor. The people working on these projects got, you know, if they worked 15 days a month, they received something like 100 kgs of maize meal, 2 pounds of cooking oil, and a little bit of powdered milk. That was their payment for hacking roads out of mountains with pickaxes. Obviously, as you can see from these pictures, it was a gendered project, right? With so many men away in the mines and factories of South Africa. What's less obvious from these pictures is that it is a heavily politicized project as well. These projects went to villages that had supported the government in the last elections, and in the run-up to the 1970 elections, you have the prime minister going around the country threatening communities, saying, if you don't support us, your self-help project will go away. And people really wanted them, because in villages that didn't have this, people were hungry. This sounds like an absolute mess and an absolute disaster, right? No big development projects. What projects are there are pretty exploitative. And yet, despite all of these failures, the Basotho I was interviewing for this project remembered this time as a hopeful one. Why? Well, first, they could work toward development in small projects in local communities. These roads did create better access to the villages, allow for better communication, allow people to get to clinics faster, allowed them to export a couple bags of grain if they had a surplus in a given year. There were small amounts of funding available, both from the government and a trickle from international organizations and governments. Second, and perhaps more importantly, they were not living in apartheid South Africa. Even those who did have to go there for work knew that they would come back to an independent Lesotho, even if it wasn't living up to all of their expectations. And third, there were small signs of progress. The government did pave a few roads, build a few clinics, put up some more schools, things like that. So in short, how do I read this? People were reframing their goals for independence as they went along, their aspirations. They had to reframe them, but they did. And since development was the only prospect they had of getting their aspirations met, they maintained hope that someday the future would arrive that they were hoping for. Was this a false hope? I don't think so. One way to judge that is in education stats. So this is a chart of the number of students in school in Lesotho. When we start out in the 1950s, we have 83,000 in primary school and exactly 814 secondary students in the entire country. Less than two decades later, we're up to almost 6,000 secondary students and 200,000 primary students. So we're seeing a massive expansion of the education system. This is one thing the British actually funded, was an expansion of the education system because they really saw nothing else to put money into and said, well, we have to do something. So they built schools and paid more teachers. But that meant that you had a significant educated cadre within Lesotho. It also meant a rising expectation. The same people who have a secondary education are not going to be happy to get, you know, to double their rural income by farming. So it's a double-edged sword. So you have increased education at this time. You also have, you know, again, as I said with the Raphael Lesedi story, you have more roads, a few more clinics, and people are able to move to places where they have access to that sometimes. So I'm going to give you three quick stories here to end this talk of people who were working for development in their own ways that I think illustrate this idea that for many Basotho, independence was the freedom from migration, whether it was successful, whether it arrived or not, but that's how they were defining it. So the first is a guy named Chaka Nsani, and again, I don't have a picture of him. He was a student leader in the Lesotho Work Camps Association. The work camps was a group that consisted of high school and university students who undertook service trips on their school holidays to construct infrastructure, as their name suggests. They received a little bit of funding from the government. The Ministry of the Interior, you know, gave them some tools and a little bit of cash. They did their own fundraising at the university campus in Roma, and they also got a little bit of money from the U.S. Embassy's self-help fund. Nsani said that the students were interested in the work camps because, quote, it was never anything that was along any of either religious, political, or sectarian lines. And I think this is why quite a few students were interested. It was an organization where they could come together as young people to do something. They built health clinics. They erected a windmill, not this exact windmill, but it's representative, in the village of Homong in the Huting district. Thanks, guys, for doing that one. And most importantly, they built a school classroom in the community of Marija in 1968. Now, why is that important? Well, Nsani claimed that the students were frequently, quote, talking about development and taking responsibility. They wanted to, quote, contribute to the situation in our own land, because if we didn't start when we were young, we would have to do things in our middle age that we should have done in our youth, end quote. It's a beautiful sentiment. And it's one you should be immediately skeptical of. You know, why is this guy telling me such a good story about this? And there are many reasons to be skeptical. Nsani worked as a government agronomist. He's a career civil servant. At the time, he was also a leader in the ruling party's youth wing. Is he just trying to whitewash the history of these groups? Right? So I was on edge a little bit while talking to him. You know, is he just trying to say everything was great at this time because my guys were in charge? But this school that they built in Marija in 1968 is a strong piece of evidence that he wasn't just blowing smoke at me. Because Marija was the site of the first Protestant mission station in the country. With politics divided along religious lines, the Catholics were for the BNP, who was in charge, the Protestants were for the opposition BCP. The fact that they were building this classroom in the center of the Protestant community suggests that his ecumenicalism was legit. And so, you know, I took that as a sign that while he probably was blowing a little bit of smoke, it wasn't perhaps as bad as it could have been. But the key here is that this group is actually physically, literally building the nation. You know, he spent his career as a government agronomist. He didn't do a day of blue-collar labor in his life. And yet there they are, the elite, the soon-to-be elite, out there building the nation, putting up the windmills in the rural communities, constructing the clinics, constructing the schools. Next story comes to us from the southern district of Hatcha's Neck. This is Malase Kokena. She was born and raised in South Africa, just across the southern border in the Matatiel district of South Africa. She came to Lesotho in her youth, fleeing Bantu education as well as the apartheid system. I never really got a good answer on it, but it appears that she was politically active in South Africa before she came, which was one reason she jumped the border. Once there, she met and married Jacob Mokgafisi Kena, who would later co-found the Lesotho Communist Party, and the two remain intimately active in South African anti-apartheid activities and politics on both sides of the border. They lived in the community of Swedike Alplas, which is very close to the southern border. In addition to being politically involved with these anti-apartheid efforts, including letting her house serve as a way station and arrival point for refugees fleeing across the border, she told me offhand, "Oh yeah, we got money from Comrade Chris, AKA Chris Hani, who was resident in Lesotho for much of the times." She also raised 7 children in the rural village, largely on her own, as her husband was often away on political work and or spending time in exile in East Germany after the political crackdown in Lesotho. Obviously, the Communist Party was banned. So she's raising 7 children and also running an underground railroad. No big deal. Her neighbors were largely ruling party supporters, so she was a political outcast in her village. But she was opportunistic in ways to support her family. She owned a small grain mill. She had fields that she would farm and sell the beans, peas, and corn from. And she made dresses that she sold by post as far away as Johannesburg. It was a really interesting story to talk to her, needless to say. But perhaps the most excited she was in her interview with me was when I asked her, "Oh, were you involved in any other groups?" It was a throwaway question at that point. She'd already told me amazing stories. And her eyes suddenly lit up, and she said, "Yes, I participated in the Homemakers Association." And I started scratching my head. The Homemakers Association was a colonial-era group dedicated to colonial domesticity, right? Raising good Christian wives for their convert husbands. And I was like, You, who wanted, you're active in the Communist Party and you were joining the Homemakers. So I started digging deeper. The organization was, by the time she joined it in the 60s and 70s, run entirely by local women. It's lost the sort of colonial era domesticity angle to it. And she said, I needed to be part of that group. She left her explicitly political groups in the region. She said, they, quote, they weren't doing anything for the nation. But the Homemakers group, they, quote, had power. And I said, well, what kind of power? She said it was a cooperative group. Women taught each other how to cook, how to prepare food, sew, can foods, and all sorts of things. They knew how to get things done, which is a really interesting take on the idea of development. In a very poor, very rural village that is female-dominated, cooking and sewing and canning foods is development at the micro scale. This is saving households money that they aren't going to have to spend at the store on the clothes or on the food. And so they can then put it into their children's education. Education isn't free at this point. Even at the primary level, you have to pay school fees. This is a way to invest in the farm, invest in the home, right? To save that money. But it's also a way of building community. Right? Without the Homemakers Association, Maliseka would have had very few inns to talk to the other women in her community, and it was a way for them to come together and to build the community, the political community that they wanted to see, that they wanted to live in with independence. And so as she got deeper into it, and as I reflected more on the story, it started to make a lot more sense why, you know, a radical communist would also be a part of the Homemakers Association. And so our final story is a man named Alexander Sakoti, and that's obviously not Alexander Sakoti. He was a 42-year-old Catholic school teacher at St. David's Mission at the primary school in the northern rural Berea district at Independence. He was also the local Boy Scout master at the school. And like most Catholics and most Catholic school teachers, he supported the BNP, the ruling party. The party wanted him to join. to become a card-carrying member, but despite the fact that Sakoti supported them, voted for them, he refused to join, in large part because of the work his scouts did with the self-help projects, with these piped water projects. His being Catholic and being a school teacher meant that he had good connections to the government offices in TY so he could secure the projects. He could say, hey, we need one in this village, we need one in that village, and could get them. Again, there was high demand and short supply for these projects. This allowed many local villages to participate, especially because Sakoti's scouts would show up and provide the needed volunteer labor, digging the trenches to put these in, which again is not easy work, especially in villages where a lot of the men are away working. So he, quote, personally went around telling people about the projects and drumming up support, but he deliberately did not join the party because that would have cut off his access to some communities, opposition-supporting communities. And Sakoti, despite leaning one way politically, said, no, I need to be able to work with everyone. His scouts, he said, were, quote, greatly loved by the communities for helping them bring the piped water, not surprising. But this is Sakoti's conception of independence. I asked him, what did he want to see from independence? He said he wanted, quote, a widening of opportunities in education, a higher sense of purpose that he instilled in a younger generation. And he wanted to see more services for rural Basutu to improve the quality of life. Again, these are people who are, despite the trying times, despite the limited resources, working to build the nation that they want to see, that has safe piped water, where women don't have to go to the spring, which in the wintertime might very well be dry. So this, you know, this again is an example of people in various parts of the country building the community they wanted to see. So what's the big picture we see out of Lesotho at independence and just after? The pre-independence dreams of big development projects and rapid widespread prosperity just did not happen. Part was that expectations were too high, but mostly it was a measure of the unwillingness of South Africa to treat Lesotho as anything but a labor reserve, as well as a lack of capacity in the Lesotho government to actually deliver on big projects. However, for most ordinary people, the promise of independence was the ability to stay in Lesotho, make a decent wage, and not have to move to South Africa as so many generations before their own had. This largely did not happen. Most had to migrate. However, when they were home in Lesotho, plenty of younger Basutu worked for the development that they wanted to see through small projects as a way of bringing about the promises and dreams of independence in an independent Lesotho. While they did not attain and achieve everything they had hoped for, their hope in the ability of development to bring about better political and economic situations was part of what independence brought to them, and a big reason why many Basutu, even to this day, remain wedded to the idea of Lesotho as home and Lesotho as the idea of economic promise. Thank you.
Great. Well, so,
just some random pictures here at the end of people living their dreams. These are all, most of the scanned pictures come from the Catholic newspaper. They ran some contest where they gave away transistor radios. There's like four or five pictures of people dressed in their finest, beaming with a transistor radio. These are building materials, like roofs for houses in the rural area. This is probably a Catholic mission way up in the mountains. And this is a dude who got some sort of higher degree just hanging out the window of his car smiling. But, you know, these are the promises of independence. So,
Kurt, would you or would someone turn on the lights, and that way we won't have our conversation in the dark. Well, I'm sure that many of you have questions. One quick thing that maybe people would be interested in. Maliseko, was she a Basutu that was raised on the South African side
yes.
of the border then?
Yes.
So she did. She was coming home, basically.
Her unmarried surname was Mashweshwe.
Okay.
So she was not just Basutu, she was of chiefly lineage Basutu, just on the other side of the border in South Africa.
Okay. Let me open it up for questions or comments. I've got a bunch if you don't. Questions? Yes, Jessica.
My question's not really fair because it's not about labor per se. It's
excellent.
It's more about ideologies and development.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm curious, just thinking about, they have this work development, but there's very little aid to get them started, as
yes.
well as very little domestic capacity. capacity. And I always think of these newly independent nations sort of in the context of the Cold War and global power relations, and that there wasn't, the British were not the only option for development aid.
True.
I'm wondering how much other options, like Soviet or Chinese aid, possibly played into realizing these dreams.
So at independence, the differences between the parties was largely around two lines. One was about how much Lesotho should cooperate with apartheid South Africa, and two was around who they would approach for foreign assistance. And so the party that ended up the ruling party, the Basotho National Party, was the party that said we need to cooperate more with South Africa and that we should only look to the West. They were violently anti-communist, and that parlayed into strong support from the Catholic Church, which was also violently anti-communist at the time. The two opposition parties said we should look to anyone but South Africa for assistance, which was coded language for we want to look to the Eastern Bloc. One party was, you know, getting support from the USSR, the other one was getting support from Maoist China. And so these remain sort of the big stumbling block, and that was one of the justifications for the coup of 1970 was that if the BNP were to turn over power to the opposition, as it should have since it lost the elections, that they would have brought about communism in Lesotho. And so South Africa was strongly supportive of the coup, funding the security forces within Lesotho. But everyone was hesitant to put any sort of aid into Lesotho in its first 5 years of independence. They're just, though the administrative capacity wasn't there for big projects, and you know, most people were saying this is Britain's responsibility. Britain was giving aid in three-year packages at the time, and it was only about £2 million. Which is not a lot of money even at the time to fund development. That's in addition to budgetary aid, but that was the development package at independence was £2 million. Botswana, which had about two-thirds as many people, actually got more development aid at independent the same week. So that miffed a lot of people in Lesotho.
John, help us understand Lesotho in 2018 compared to your story. That is, how much is still an out-migration? And the one thing that's related to that is you really were talking in one case about, there was a graph numbers about continuing, their desire to continue to work in South Africa for the next 5 years, and the numbers were high. But was there always an assumption by the Basotho that they were going home, that once their working days were over, that they were not going to be staying in South Africa, but they were going to be in effect back in the mountains?
There were always some that you know wanted to stay in South Africa. The bright lights of the city, it's a real thing. Lesotho is relatively poor and mountainous and rural, and doesn't, even to this day, a lot of places lack electric and running water and things like that. So you know, at the time there were some who, despite the fact that apartheid was on, wanted to stay. Just because of the better services, the better nightlife, you name it, the better jobs. That said, most people still considered Lesotho their home. So even if they spent their time, you know, their quarter century or whatever, working in South Africa, a lot of them maintained an investment in Lesotho, whether that was sending a small amount of money home to family so that they could return there at retirement, or actually, you know, building up the rural homestead, you know, sending the money for cattle and things like that so that they had a nest egg to return to in Lesotho. A lot of Basotho paid taxes on both places just to make sure that they had a claim in both countries as a deliberate strategy. Today, that is changing, I would say. There is widespread disillusionment in the failure of development, much wider than there was at the time. People are, they've had it up to here with the Lesotho government and the promises of development because it still just isn't there. There aren't many local jobs. And the latest Afrobarometer surveys suggest that a third of Basotho want to see Lesotho become part of South Africa. A third of them want Lesotho to stay independent. A third of them want some sort of federal solution with open borders and work permits and things like that. The Lesotho government just caved recently, and allowed for dual citizenship. For years, they were the stumbling block to dual citizenship. South Africa allowed it. Basutu wanted it because it would give them rights to work in South Africa, but also to go home and back and forth to maintain, you know, the connections. But, you know, I think the movement is towards some sort of federal solution like that. There's too much to be lost by the political class in Lesotho by becoming South Africa's poor 10th province. But there's also too much to be lost from actual rioting and, you know, upheaval in Lesotho from a disaffected population to continue with the status quo. That's, you know, as a historian, that's my contemporary read on things.
Okay. Other questions? Yes.
Was the reason for the labor migration into South Africa because there weren't enough South African workers, or was it just because they were both British colonies and it was just normal to have workers come?
It depends on who you're talking about. For the gold mines, especially, the Lesotho laborers were wonderful because they kept down the wages and the demands of South African workers. And so they really liked the Basutu migrants because they had a pliant workforce. They had to live in hostels. They had control over them. And by the sheer numbers of them coming, they could keep wages very, very low. On the farms in the Free State that relied on Basutu labor, they had no other option. You know, the other option was trying to recruit people out of the townships, and, you know, who's going to leave Soweto to go live on a rural farm in the Free State where you're completely at the mercy and whim of your employer, who is an Afrikaner? Just not viable. So it depends on where you're looking in the economy, but by and large, the capitalists, the titans of industry, loved having Lesotho as a labor reserve, and the government of South Africa did as well, because they could kick them out if they were troublesome. You know, you don't belong here. See ya. And they helped keep wages down, which is what the big supporters of the government wanted. And British colonial policy as well supported it, because there was, you know, the rural farmers in Lesotho in a bad year couldn't pay their taxes. So, but who could? The migrant laborers. They actually had to pay the mines paid the money into a special account that the people could draw on once they got back to Lesotho, and the government swept off the interest from that in Lesotho as well. So, you know, there were many ways to profit from migrant laborers.
Other questions that folks have? Yes.
I wasn't aware of this. I don't know if you call it a movement, but a significant proportion of the population of Lesotho being interested in potentially merging with South Africa.
Yeah.
Which led me to, earlier in the talk, I had the question of why this country exists in the first place. I realized I didn't know.
Yeah.
But the question I have is about South Africa's response to migrant workers from Lesotho nowadays. You hear a lot in the press about violence in South Africa, but oftentimes the stories you hear about people from Zimbabwe,
right,
and other parts of Sub-Saharan Africa, not necessarily so much from Lesotho, but are they treated similarly poorly?
I would say they are probably the best positioned of all migrants within South Africa, because there are so many Basutu in South Africa as well who aren't originally from Lesotho. You know, the border crossed over them in the 19th century. Your back question is actually important to that story, which is, you know, through the middle of the 19th century, the Basutu were slowly retreating basically to what is today their mountain enclave. But it means that they lost their best agricultural lands, and many Basutu communities remained in what is today South Africa, in what people in Lesotho call the conquered territory, which is the majority of the Free State province. But those strong connections means that it's really hard to identify who is Basutu Balasutu, Basutu from Lesotho, or Basutu of South Africa. They speak the same language, they have the same cultural understandings, many of them have identity documents in South Africa as well. So, you know, it's in many ways why I say they're one of the best positioned groups, is because they blend a lot easier and they have such a long history. Plenty of those miners stayed. and built a family. And so, you know, are they Basotho from Lesotho? Are they South African? You know, how many generations are you looking? These sorts of things. And so the anti-foreigner sentiment is most often played out with the Somalis, who are easily identifiable, with recently arrived Zimbabweans who don't have the sort of tight community connections. There's also a great book by Gary Kynock on the Russian gangs. The Basotho called themselves Ma Russians and created like self-policing groups for their communities that basically beat up non-Basotho in the townships. And so there's, you know, community vigilantism on behalf of Basotho as well. That's still there too, to some extent.
And some of the violence is actually Nigerians and others from deeper in Africa who have come down to South Africa have had, I think, the greatest problems. And
more those who are more noticeably different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Other yes, back
the
here.
The blacker ones, as people often say.
Thanks for that talk, John. It's really interesting. Could you talk a little bit more about the what we might call civil society that developed these ways of getting things done through the homemakers and the
workers? Yeah.
At a point where the parties themselves had created a kind of stalemate. Is that a good way of describing it?
It's a very good way of describing it. And a lot of these groups, I argue in the book that there's sort of a period between about 1965 and 1970 that these groups have their heyday. In the sort of wild isn't a good way to describe that. In the days right after independence, right, in the first years when there's still multi-party democracy, in large part, these groups arise out of the schools and school groups, both at the university, but especially even at secondary schools. And they develop at this time in particular because of that school expansion that's going on, right? The schools are expanding very, very fast. And as the schools expand, you know, well, the premier high school that was there has these organizations. Why don't we have these organizations? The Boy Scouts, the Girl Guides, the Junior Red Cross, the Homemakers. You know, they're in all the schools, the Student Christian Movement, the Lesotho Work Camps. And in most of these schools, in many of these schools that are, you know, that are popping up and having these chapters, they don't have a lot of experienced teachers. So a lot of these groups are actually being run by the students themselves. Or there's, you know, one person who's overseeing the group at three different schools, but that means that most of the meetings are being run on local initiative. And so there's a real sort of opportune window for students to just make and do. And I had a number of people tell me, yeah, we didn't really have a leader. We just kind of fundraised for ourselves. And, you know, as Boy Scouts, we went on camping trips. And then we did a community service project. Or, you know, I interviewed a nun and she's like, yeah, we just knitted hats and scarves for the local community and went out and harvested, you know, the food for people, for the old members of the community who needed that. You know, winter was coming, there's still grain in their fields. We harvested it. And on one level, that's, you know, just sort of niceness and part of the calling as a Catholic nun. But on the other hand, that's also the community you want to see, that you are building that. But they had the opportunity because the leadership wasn't so set, like it wasn't so hierarchical. You know, the organizations weren't particularly entrenched, and so Chaka and Sani and his group could decide where they wanted to go. You know, we get 2,000 rand and that's enough to build, a windmill and a clinic. Let's pick here and here. And they went and did it. You know, a little bit of fundraising for transport and food for the week you're there and it's done. So it was the lack of capacity was negative in that the government couldn't attract the funding, but it opened some space for people to be able to work at the grassroots in ways that weren't as possible now when, you know, the entrenched development industry is there and you have to go through the procurement process and write the grant and, you know, do all of the stuff that a bureaucracy says you do to build a project. So yeah, there was a moment there of 4 or 5 years.
John, but it raises, I was automatically, when you were talking about our mother of seven, I was reminded of the old T-shirt, a women's knitting society and terrorist organization.
right.
You know, that was popular at one point here in the U.S. So that it raises the issue of the primacy of women, mm-hmm. and whether or not women in that civil society moment ever really got, you know, a great amount of political power within Lesotho, or was it you know, continually male dominated?
In terms of actual political power at the national level, no. It's still very, very male dominated. In terms of women running local communities, they still do. You know, I taught in a Catholic school that was run by nuns. Word on the street was they ran out of priests every 3 years because they just couldn't stand the community and couldn't abide by the fact that the women ran the place, and you know, they were out of there. So, you know, at the local level, there's strong, you know, strong women's groups, all sorts of stuff. At the national level, there's only one of 30 political parties that's headed by a woman, maybe two, only one that has any sort of power whatsoever. So there's been a disconnect, and there's been a number of court cases recently that have rejected the idea that women can accede to the chieftaincy. You know, the women become chieftains, but only when their husbands die. And the daughters cannot ascend to the chieftaincy, just ruled by the Supreme Court last year in Lesotho. So it's this disconnect between sort of national level and local level.
Great. Any other questions or comments for John? I forgot to thank the African Studies Center, which has not only been a co-sponsor of today's talk, but is a co-sponsor of next Monday's talk by Darcy and Jim Green about the exhibit down below us. And they're going to do a gallery walk in that exhibit after their talk on Monday. So
Very cool.
Please come back. Let's give John another round of applause for a great talk.
Thank you all.
So do